Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod. Rebuilding Baltimore's port after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. Maryland's Governor Wes Moore has one message to lawmakers voting on aid.
Maryland doesn't need favors. What Maryland needs right now is for us to have a coordinated and a bipartisan response to something that is going to have a cataclysmic impact on the American economy.
And veteran venture capitalist Alan Patricoff is getting in on the next tech revolution, AI.
I think this is the most significant inflection point.
At 89, he loves to work.
I'm going to live to 114, remember.
And he's investing in the longevity economy for everyone else.
I think it's 55 million people over the age of 65 are still working, and there are going to be 80 million people in the next 20 years that are going to be over age 65. So the workforce has to be different.
Plus, strong jobs growth in March and fending off activist bugs in the boardroom in any industry.
There's such a thing as corporate gadflies taking things a bit too far.
By the way, there's some people who would think that Nelson Peltz is a gadfly.
It's Friday, April 5th, 2024. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Andrew Ross Sorkin. Joe is out today.
First up today on the podcast, Fed Speak versus Jobs Day. This week, an array of Fed officials have said in public commentary that maybe, just maybe, 2024 would not see a change in interest rate policy after all. We might not see a cut in interest rates because the I word, inflation, is still overstaying its welcome. Last week, the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation measure, the data point policymakers return to over and over again, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, PCE, showed an annualized rate of 2.5% for February. Other inflation gauges are showing more than 3%. Yeah, that's higher than the 2% number, the goal number that the Fed wants. Chairman Jay Powell explained how tricky this road is to travel.
On inflation, it is too soon to say whether the recent readings represent more than just a bump. We do not expect that it will be appropriate to lower our policy rate until we have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down toward 2%.
On our Squawk Box TV broadcast Wednesday, Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic said that he expects maybe one rate cut this year, but not for a while.
If the economy evolves as I expect, and that's going to be seeing continued robustness in GDP, in employment, and a slow decline of inflation through the course of the year, I think it'll be appropriate for us to start moving down at the end of this year, the fourth quarter.
Thursday, Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari was the latest to say rate cuts may not be needed at all if progress on inflation stalls. Here are his comments at a virtual event.
In March, I had jotted down 2 rate cuts this year. If inflation continues to fall back towards our 2% target. But if we continue to see inflation moving sideways, then that would make me question whether we needed to do those rate cuts at all. There's a lot of momentum in the economy right now.
If you look at a chart of stock market performance for Thursday during the day, you can actually see the moment when the markets took a turn after Kashkari made that comment. That leaves us now on track for the market's worst week in a year, and investors closely watching these comments in light of today's big number, the U.S. jobs data. Now, the American economy created 303,000 jobs in the month of March. Better than expected, but are we on strong enough footing? We got into all of that today with our Becky Quick, CNBC's Steve Leisman, and CNBC's Rick Santelli. You'll hear them all now.
Labor force participation? Wow. 62.7. That is a nice jump. We were at 62.5 last month, and 62.6 was expected. So these numbers are definitely stronger than expected.
Rick, stay right there. Let's bring in the rest of our jobs panel on this for some instant reaction. Steve, let's start with you. Dig through the numbers. Tell us where those jobs actually were occurring. 303,000 versus the 200,000 that was the estimate.
Okay, so I was just able to calculate on the fly. Did not double check my numbers, but okay, I had a calculator here. 68% of the jobs coming from three sectors, if I'm not mistaken here.
Okay.
You can guess what they are, Becky, I bet.
Restaurants, maybe? Leisure?
Leisure, hospitality, that's 49.
Government?
Government's 71. That's two for two. I'm going to call you a winner because you got two out of three.
Yeah, tell me, what's the third?
Which ain't bad, according to some song.
And oh, no, I'm not going to get the third.
Oh, education, and health services.
Yeah, right.
Those have been the three. 68%, 203,000, I think, or 200-something thousand, came from those three sectors. I'm not seeing a lot of strength outside of those three sectors here. This is the test right now, folks. You are being tested in the market of this theory that the headline number doesn't matter as much as the inflationary indicators inside. Now, the payroll was a little bit hot. The reason why the year-over-year comes down is you have some bigger numbers dropping out of the calculation from prior. There were 0.4, 0.5s in the rearview mirror. Those are dropping out. And you replace it with a 0.35, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was a little on the high side, but still your year-over-year comes down. But the big story of the day may be the participation rate. Technically, theoretically, as long as the labor force is increasing in size and you have bodies to fill jobs without creating stress and needing to bid up wages quite so much, that is not an inflationary development. It's okay to put as many people to work
as
want to come to work at a wage that is not greater than the sum of, as we talked about in the last hour, inflation plus productivity. I'll leave it there because there may be people on the who disagree with me.
Just to dig into that a little bit, the idea that we are bringing more people back into the workforce, this is what we've been waiting for since the COVID pandemic broke out. The idea, are you going to get these bodies back into the workforce? Did they run out of savings? Did they get forced to be brought back? Are they looking at better job opportunities than they had seen before?
I think all of the above. You can't know it. Like, you can have your glass half empty and say, people are only going to work because they need the jobs. Well, when did jobs become a welfare program? It's not. Jobs are being offered and paid for because employers have worked for people.
No,
to
but
do.
If you have run down your savings,
if you had
excess savings, as the American public did during COVID, from a lot of government handouts that came out from other places that they were saving from maybe money they weren't spending because they weren't traveling.
If you can work from home and do two jobs from home now that you could only do one before because you were spending time commuting? Or what if you were on the sidelines? What if you were on the sidelines as a retiree and somebody said,
I'll give you 40 bucks to come back to work, and before that it wasn't worth it.
And then there's the other side of the thing. So there's no way to know, is it one or the other? One thing I could look at is what the participation rate is of seniors or older folks.
Are they coming back into the workforce?
But more than just waiting to get back to the pandemic level, we have exceeded the pandemic level. We have brought more people back into the workforce.
Hold on a minute, folks.
Go ahead,
don't get too excited, though. We had three readings last year that were 62.8. Three readings last year at 62.8. We had it in November. We had it in September. We had it in August last year. So even though it's important and it's jumped from 62.5, it's not like we haven't been there and done that
recently. And we're still below. You're right, Rick. Rick, I could see that point. We're still about a half a point below where we were, although I got to look at the prime age number, which I'll look at in a second. But that, I think, had already exceeded it. But we have this issue of seniors actually having dropped out of the workforce. And there's a weird situation of them not coming back. And that's part of the reason.
Let's tell you about the other story that helped spark yesterday's market sell-off. Oil prices extending gains at Brent topping $91 a barrel, with WTI hovering now around $87. It's supported in part by rising geopolitical tensions, unfortunately, in the Middle East. And crude is on track to gain more than 4% after this, just this week, this after Iran vowed revenge against Israel for its attack on the embassy compound in Syria that killed two high-ranking military commanders. Israel has not claimed responsibility for the attack, but reports say the CIA has warned that Iran could retaliate against Israel within the next 48 hours. And it feels to me The oil markets have moved on this news, but the equity markets have largely not really moved in a meaningful way, if you believe, and I hope we're not on the brink of something, you know, horrific and terrible, but we seem to be getting closer and closer to something.
What I will say is, if you were looking at the European markets this morning, there was some weakness in those European markets, and a lot of that was from higher oil prices. Right. It's Lufthansa and some of the other big airlines that were suffering from this, as you look at higher prices across the board with issues. But yeah, the question of what happens next.
If we're in a really bad place, you'd think it would be toppling lots of things.
This week saw the culmination of a months-long proxy battle pitting Disney against Trian's Nelson Peltz. The two biggest players in that fight spoke out on CNBC yesterday. First up, here's what Disney CEO Bob Iger said about the company's focus after winning that proxy battle.
Clearly, shareholders care about that, given, you know, what the company's been through these last few years.
Yes.
As you'd expect, they care about what ends up being our top priorities strategically. They want to know about the future of ESPN. They want to know about streaming and how that can be profitable. They care about the quality of our films, and they're very interested in growing our parks and resorts business, where we said we're going to spend $60 billion over the next 10 years.
Shortly after that interview, Nelson Peltz joined Squawk on the Street to respond.
I hope Bob can keep his promises. I hope they can do all the things they assured us they were going to do. And we'll only watch and wait. If they do it, they won't hear from me again. If they don't, Jim, you may be seeing me on your show next year doing this same thing again.
Shares of Disney fell by 1.6% in yesterday's session, now down 4% for the week. And Andrew, that's what you said yesterday.
You know,
he may not go away quietly,
and it's going to continue to, I mean, even without him on the board, there's going to be continued pressure. There's going to be continued pressure on the business just because of the challenges, the macro challenges, and because I think Nelson has a particular interest in this. We'll see whether he holds on to the stock or not. I think the bigger person to pay attention to in regard to Nelson is actually Ike Perlmutter. Does Ike continue to hold the shares? Does he get rid of the shares?
Because he had a big chunk of pledged his votes to Trian.
He is the Nelson Peltz proxy vote, if you will. I mean, I don't want to say Nelson Peltz is a front for Ike Perlmutter, but almost, if you really understand what was happening there. So if Ike Perlmutter continues to own his shares and then decides that he doesn't like what's happening, maybe they'll try this all over again. Having said that, you know, clearly it wasn't a winning strategy. But again, you got to see where Disney's going to be a year from now.
Well, and when you say where Disney is, I mean, it's probably where the stock is.
Right.
I mean, the stock has been up 30% year to date, which is probably why Iger was able to maintain control on what happened. Nelson went away. Peltz went away.
The first time.
First time when Iger came back in because the stock popped immediately on that news. And Nelson came on with Jim and said, hey, all's good. We're out of here. So I think watch the stock pretty closely, and that will tell you what happens next.
Let's talk about this, though, because a small activist hedge fund seeking to force BlackRock to bar Larry Fink from serving as both chairman and CEO. Bluebell Capital Partners launching a shareholder proposal to split the roles and is seeking an overhaul of the board. Bluebell has been targeting BlackRock now for about 3 years. This isn't really the first time they've gone through down this rodeo, accusing it of taking contradictory and inconsistent approaches to ESG investing. In response, BlackRock's board saying the proposal isn't in the shareholders' best interest and that having Fink in both roles is the most appropriate and effective leadership structure for the board and the company. The Wall Street Journal reporting the Bluebell stake likely less than 0.01% of BlackRock's $120 billion market cap. And I still think that there needs to be some kind of threshold rule that the SEC puts in place. I know we want to make things, I mean,
they own
on one side, you want to make it more democratic, and I understand that argument. And on the other side, you know, it's sort of hard to have a vote if you're at that level. And then the distraction
they own how much?
0.01%. By the way, it's 120.
Larry Fink owns, he's the largest individual shareholder.
Right. But it's a $120 billion company. So you're not going to find individual shareholders that are going to own huge amounts of the company. So maybe you do want them to have a say. But again, this is a big governance question. And we've also seen the governance question of having a chairman and a CEO in the same role, which I believe actually a majority now.
Of companies,
I don't know if the if you're in the Fortune 100, the majority is both. But actually, if you're outside of that It's not.
It's interesting. And then, of course, but again, he's the largest shareholder in the company. He probably owns more shares than they do.
Of course.
I believe in democracy, but you also, there's such a thing as corporate gadflies taking things a bit too far and taking the focus off what happens
and
with
that
companies.
That is, by the way, there's some people who would think that Nelson Peltz is a gadfly, right? I mean, that's the question.
Next on Squawk Pod, we're headed to Maryland, where efforts to clear the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore and restore its shipping port are underway. Maryland Governor Wes Moore joins us.
The Port of Baltimore is responsible for $70 billion of economic activity, employs tens of thousands of people, 900 businesses rely on the Port of Baltimore.
And the governor's message to members of Congress reluctant to pass federal aid.
This is bigger than Baltimore. This is bigger than the state of Maryland.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
This is Squawk Pod.
Up and Andrew, Q.
Welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square on this Friday morning. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Becky Quick. Joe is off today. President Biden preparing to visit the site of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore today. Efforts to rebuild are starting to get political. Emily Wilkins joins us right now with more on that.
Well, good morning, Andrew. Well, yeah, President Biden, you know, he promised federal funds to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge, but he is already facing pushback from Congress. A group of 3 to 4 dozen hardline conservatives, the House Freedom Caucus, are out this morning with a new statement saying that any funding for the bridge needs to meet several conditions. They include making sure that any spending on the bridge is offset to keep government spending in check. They also want to end the current limits on liquid natural gas exports and ease federal regulations around the bridge's reconstruction to speed up that rebuild. Biden, meanwhile, is expected to ask for the federal government to cover 100% of the cost for repairing the bridge. And that's similar to what happened back in 2007 when a bridge in Minnesota collapsed. Of course, then Congress approved $250 million to repair the bridge in 5 days. We're expecting it to take longer this time, both because of the politics around this and as lawmakers are grappling with whether to approve billions in funding for Ukraine and Israel. And of course, guys, we are still waiting for Biden to actually request a price tag on exactly how much funding is going to be needed to rebuild that bridge. Becky?
Emily, thank you very much. Right now, we want to bring in a special guest to talk about the bridge collapse and the efforts to rebuild. Maryland Governor Wes Moore. Governor Moore, first of all, our condolences. This has been a national calamity. We've watched from afar. Can you bring us up to speed on what the situation is there?
Thank you so much. And the state is still very much mourning because you're right. We have, we lost six individuals during that time, six Marylanders. And we have told the families and we will continue to tell them that we will do anything that we can do to bring them not just a sense of closure, but a sense of comfort. But we also know that the calamity was not just human, it was also economic. This is one of the most important ports in the entire country, one of the most important maritime vehicles that America has. The Port of Baltimore is responsible for $70 billion of economic activity, employs tens of thousands of people, 900 businesses rely on the Port of Baltimore. And so when you're seeing now an unprecedented maritime disaster, where you have a ship that is the size of the Eiffel Tower and the weight of the Washington Monument that is now sitting in the middle of the Patapsco River with a bridge on top of it and about 27,000 tons of debris in the water. This is not just dangerous. It's not just a complicated operation, but it's one that we know doesn't just have an impact on Maryland, but has an impact on the larger American economy as well.
The complicating factors that you mentioned, the ship with the bridge on top of it in the water, which, by the way, deals with tidal waters, so changing tides constantly. How long do you anticipate that this is going to take just to clean up the disaster and then move beyond that to try and rebuild the bridge?
You're absolutely right. When you add on complications of not just debris and wreckage that is in the water, I mean, our divers cannot see any further than a foot or two in front of them because of the amount of debris in the water. But you also have the issue of weather and wind, which also complicates it. Now, we have been working, this has been an operation and a unified command that's been working literally 24/7, working with the U.S. Coast Guard, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Navy SupSolve, and also local leaders and local elected officials, the Maryland State Police. And we just received word from the Army Corps of Engineers that they believe that within a month, we can open up at least a channel of a 35-foot depth. Which is a significant milestone because that's what's necessary for things like new cars and heavy trucks, where the Port of Baltimore is the largest port for new cars and heavy trucks in this country. And then hopefully within a month after that, we'll be able to open up to the fuller 50-foot depth. But we know that is going to be an all-hands-on-deck 24/7 operation for us to be able to hit those type of timelines, but it's one that we're prepared to take on.
The ship's owner and management company went to court to try and limit their liability to something like $43 million. That come as a surprise or a concern?
It's not a surprise. We were expecting it. We're prepared for it. I know there needs to be a full and a thorough investigation, but I also know this. If people need to be held to account for what happened on that day, they need to be held to account and they need to be responsible for it. So we know it's an active investigation. We would like to see a speedy process with that investigation. And while we're not surprised on the ask for the limit of liability, I know the thing that we urge is there needs to be accountability for what happened that night.
I'm sure you just heard the report from Emily Wilkinson about that group of 3 to 4 dozen hardline conservatives who want any federal funds to go through several hoops before they will approve it. You have any thoughts on that?
The thing I would just remind people is this is bigger than Baltimore. This is bigger than the state of Maryland. The Port of Baltimore is one of the largest and most efficient ports that we have in this country, a real leader in the entire maritime industry. And so when we're talking about how does this impact Maryland, this doesn't just impact Marylanders. This is impacting the farmer in Kentucky because the largest port in this country for agricultural equipment is the Port of Baltimore. This doesn't just, you know, this impacts the auto worker in Ohio because the largest port in this country for new cars, heavy trucks, is the Port of Baltimore. This impacts the restaurant owner in Tennessee because the largest port in this country for spices and sugars is the Port of Baltimore. If you're working in coal, you rely on the Port of Baltimore. So the Port of Baltimore is not a Maryland issue. People need to rally around support for this industry and support for this port, not because you're doing Maryland a favor. Maryland doesn't need favors. What Maryland needs right now is for us to have a coordinated and a bipartisan response to something that is going to have a cataclysmic impact on the American economy.
Have you spoken with congressional leaders in Washington?
We have. We've spoken with congressional leaders and frankly, congressional leaders and state leaders, chief executives and governors from both sides of the aisle. And I'm encouraged because I think the things that we continue to hear is that there has to be a bipartisan approach to be able to deal with not just the human tragedy, but also the economic tragedy. And I can tell you, if you look at the state of Maryland and how we are moving in a unified fashion with both local, state, and federal leaders, our federal delegation, both Democrats and Republicans in our federal delegation are all united on this. So I think Maryland is continuing to lead in that, and I think helping to show an example for the rest of the country that in times like this, it's important to put the politics aside, and it's important to focus on what is going to be best for the people, for the businesses, and for the industries that continue to drive our country.
Wes, I guess this really lands in the House. Have you spoken with the House Speaker Johnson on this?
I personally have not spoken with Speaker Johnson yet. I know our congressional delegation has. In fact, I was just speaking yesterday with Congressman Kwesi Enfume, who actually represents the district that was impacted by this. And I know he has said he's had a few very good conversations with the speaker. So we're hopeful. We're hopeful that we'll be able to come with a coordinated response and one that doesn't just meet the moment, but one that honors the foundation of this country and what it is that we're trying to accomplish together.
Wes Moore, the governor of Maryland. Governor, thank you for your time. And again, we send our condolences and speedy wishes for everything you all are dealing with there right now.
God bless you. Thank you.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, longtime tech investor Alan Patricoff on the AI revolution.
I've been through every one of them, the PC revolution, the cell phone revolution, the internet revolution. Nothing is comparable to this.
He's 89 and nowhere near retired. The veteran venture capitalist is now focused on investing in the longevity economy, and he says it's time to rethink aging.
They fought feminism, they fought racism. Now we have to fight ageism because there could be a lot more people who are living longer and who are going to be active, and we've got to think about older people in a more constructive manner.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
This is Squawk Pod, today with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Andrew.
I want to talk tech and AI. I want to welcome Alan Patricoff, co-founder and chairman of Primetime Partners, to the table. Good morning to you, one of the great veteran venture capitalists in the world. We're all trying to figure out what to make of AI and where the investment opportunities really are or maybe really aren't. What do you think?
Well, you know, I've been through these cycles so many times, and I'm in the camp that says, you know, be cautious. I mean, I've seen these run-ups. Everybody gets excited. Valuations get driven up, particularly in the private market, when there's no basis for actually determining what something is worth. And so a lot of people are going to make money, but there are going to be a lot of
unhappy
faces.
But are you, we were talking to Steve Cohen about this earlier this week, this idea of sort of, are we in an AI bubble?
And he doesn't think so.
He doesn't think so.
Yeah.
But then I said to him, you know, are we in 1996? I'm curious, if you were to try to put a date on where this is comparable to some time in history when there's been a major inflection point in technology, is this that?
I think this is the most significant inflection point. And, you know, Andrew, I've been through every one of them. PC revolution, the cell phone revolution, the internet revolution. Nothing is comparable to this because it affects every aspect of business. I mean, even our area, which, you know, I'm selfish in telling you, you know, I focus on now investing in anything, products, services, technologies, experiences for older people. And when AI became so hot last year, particularly, I said, you know, where's it going to affect our audience? Because, you know, I couldn't see it right away, but already I can see it. I mean, I can tell you four or five companies that we're in that I wouldn't have thought had, you know, this had any implication. Well, I'll give you one. We have a company called SafeRide, which does what they call NEMT, non-emergency transportation.
Okay.
They are picking up people. It sounds like Uber or a Lyft, which, by the way, always tells you 1 minute and they're 7 minutes. They can't afford it. So they have to be exactly on time, deliver you to a doctor or a hospital on time. Not ambulance. They're not ambulances, and pick you up exactly right. And they have a 99% reliability. How do they do it? With very sophisticated internal technology.
Let me ask you this. When you think about making an investment in AI today, there's these large language models. There's really, call it three or four large language models. And the thing that I can't figure out is, over time, as they get better, it seems to me that there's a likelihood that a lot of the stuff they can do will usurp some of the apps and other kinds of software that's being developed to sort of serve them. Meaning that as the large language models get better, they may actually be able to do what everybody else is trying to build. which would then sort of upend the entire thing. There's no moat to any of these businesses. Your business, the business you just mentioned, seems like it would likely have a moat. There's a physical component to it.
Yeah, well, AI is going to have its biggest, in my opinion, place I would be putting my bets if I were investing specifically in AI, is AI where it's applications in particular industries, not necessarily the platforms. I mean, ChatGPT, it's obviously taken over the world, including me, and probably both of you. But I worry about how many more, I mean, of course, they've got share of mind at the moment, but this is ubiquitous across everything. I'd be more interested as a long-term investor in how in an AI application that affects the medical industry
it makes it more productive. I mean, we were just having this conversation about productivity. Do you think we're on the verge of a supercharged productivity?
Absolutely dramatic. It's going to be overwhelming. I mean, I see it. I say it all the areas. I mean, we have another company, Sheer Health, telling you what they're doing. I would never have thought of it. We all get our medical bills, and we never know what we got and why we got it and why we have copays. Right. They've developed AI, AI, being able to take your medical bills and actually finding out where you got the right charge, where you didn't, and recover.
Can they tell you before you get services done? Because you usually find out 6 months after that.
Well, if you know what they're going to charge you, they should, because if they know what services you're going to get, they should be able to tell you what the appropriate is for whatever coverage you've got. I mean, that is where the applications are, and using AI is going to accelerate things. I mean, you know, get answers so much faster, and it's going to put a lot of people out of work, but it'll employ new people.
I got a different one for you. I want to talk about retirement, though you are hardly retiring. You're 89 years old.
I'll be 90 this year.
My kids are
trying to figure out how to celebrate.
Just got married again, remarkable. So you are not in the retirement. You're never going to retire. But there's going to be a lot of people who are going to have to retire at some point in life.
And you read my book.
Yes.
I'm going to live to 114.
I know. That's why. But I'm curious if you think the private markets, that you know, Larry Fink wrote this whole thing about retirement and the problems of the system.
It is.
And the question is whether the private markets or the public markets or some kind of new system has to be developed. And I'm curious where you land on that.
New system for older people?
Yeah. I mean,
new system for building up retirement funds to make sure.
Oh, yeah. Listen, the first message, everyone, invest as much as you can in your 401k. That's the first message that goes to anyone, whether they're 18 or maybe too late if you're 65. But we're, you know, the population of working people, for example, now, there are like, I think it's 55 million people over the age of 65 are still working, and they're going to be 80 million people in the next 20 years that are going to be over age 65. So the workforce has to be different.
Right.
At the same time, companies have to plan more because there's so many people in the workforce. What should happen to those people after they do want to retire? Should you try to keep them? Should you try to find something for them to do? Should you be helpful to them? Should you have systems installed that prepare them for retirement? Yeah. I mean, it's a big thing. I think you'll be amused. I spoke at a conference last week called Upfront out in California, and the title of the section I spoke on with two other veteran venture capitalists is "Why the F are we still doing this?"
Right.
I mean, people.
So what's
are
the answer?
Working, well, you love the business, and you. I love. Startups and young companies, and I love this particular area because, you know, everyone's fought they fought feminism, they fought racism. Now we have to fight ageism because there are going to be a lot more people who are living longer and who are going to be active, and we've got to think about older people in a more constructive manner, and we've got to find things, and we have to find things, but people are going to develop things for
Amen
them
to
do
that.
And keep them busy.
Yeah, you can't sit around for 30 or 40 years.
And how to take care of the ones that get sick.
Right.
You know, there are 55 million people, according to the government, who are non-paid caregivers for someone in their family. I don't know if you have any of those problems, but almost everybody has someone, and there are people who have to give up their work or cut their job, their time at the office, in order to take the government. It was in Biden's State of the Union message, we got to do more about caregiving. So these are all great, great areas.
The one and only Alan Patrickoff, thank you for joining us this morning. It's great to see you.
It's always fun to be with you.
Always.
That's Squawk Pod for today and for the week. Thank goodness it's Friday. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. Get the best of that show in this podcast. Follow Squawk Pod wherever you are listening now. And let us know what you think. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, do me a favor, rate or review Squawk Pod right on that platform. That will help other listeners find us. We'll meet you right back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.